Nearly 500 men are being held at Guantanamo Bay Prison, which opened in Cuba to detain those allegedly associated with Al-Qaeda. After 4 years of the prison's operation, the majority of these men have yet to be charged with any crime. In August last year, the U.S. military reported that 76 detainees had begun a hunger strike to protest their confinement at the prison. Joining us today from New York is an attorney for several of these detainees, Joshua Colangelo Bryan. Welcome to The Politics of Food.
Thanks very much.
Well, Joshua, what measures is the U.S. military taking to end the strike?
The military, as it has now admitted, began to take fairly extreme steps to end the hunger strike in January. More specifically, as was described to me and described to other attorneys by their clients, the group of hunger strikers who'd been on a hunger strike since last August were told that the rules of the game were changing. They were told by military officers that the hunger strikers, were challenging the U.S. and that the U.S. would challenge them back. Hmm. And specifically, they were told that if they refused to eat solid food, they would be strapped into chairs and force-fed several bags of fluids. My client, Issa, to whom these statements were made, refused to eat solid food. He was then taken by what's known as an IRF, an immediate response force, grabbed violently, pulled out of his cell, and strapped into a chair. The military has admitted buying somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 of these chairs from a company in the U.S., which markets the chairs as a padded cell on wheels. Issa, as with others, was strapped into the chair, his ankles, his wrists, his head, around his waist, and given two bags of fluids through a tube in his nose. The problem was that after being on a hunger strike since August, as Issa described it, his stomach had become quite small.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was given the first bag of fluids in about 15 minutes, and this is a bag that contains 1,200 cc's of fluid, it started to cause pretty serious pain. When he was given the second bag in about the same amount of time, he described feeling like someone had stuck a knife in his stomach.
Now, this is very excruciating. Do you know, and this is also an amount that is far above what is normally given after a fast.
I think I read it was 12 times over the amount that's normally given. Is that right?
Well, I talked to a doctor, obviously not being one myself, who said that he had never heard of anyone being given more than 100 cc's of fluid in perhaps an hour under similar circumstances. So this certainly is well beyond what any physician I talk to would characterize as appropriate treatment.
And how long had Issa not been eating?
He had stopped eating on August 8th, and the events I'm describing took place on or about January 10th.
So no food or drink at all?
He had been fed through a tube in his nose. As to whether he ever had anything to drink, I'm not certain that he didn't. But in terms of nutrition, everything he was receiving was going through a nose tube.
Now, what compelled Issa and others in his position to basically starve themselves to death?
There was a hunger strike that began in June of 2005. The reasons behind the hunger strike were several. First, the detainees or the hunger strikers were protesting that they were being held without ever having a fair hearing and that they were being told they could be held for the rest of their lives without ever having a fair hearing. They were protesting the fact that their religious practices were being interfered with. For example, guards would talk over or make fun of the call to prayer. They would talk or make fun of the detainees while they were praying. And also, as we've heard, there were examples of the Quran not being treated properly. The protest also was about simple conditions like food and water being rotten, as well as the fact that the military was classifying detainees on a four-level scale and treating them differently depending upon which classification the detainee was put in. So the basic message as described to me by my clients was, these issues need to be resolved or we want to die. Mm-hmm. Shortly after that hunger strike began, the military made certain promises to our clients as to changes that would be made. And the detainees stopped the hunger strike for a period of time to see if those promises would in fact be followed through on. When, in the detainees' estimation, the promises were not fulfilled, a group recommenced or began a second hunger strike in early August.
Could you tell me what a hunger strike does to someone? Is it going to change their? I know it's got to change their mental perspective, but does it play with their head in any way? Are they likely to hallucinate? Are they likely to, you know, what's breaking down inside them?
Well, again, I can only speak from the experiences I've had dealing with my clients, as opposed to giving a comprehensive overview of hunger strike symptoms. What I observed was that my clients lost weight, they became gaunt, they certainly became physically weaker. However, I didn't notice in my conversations with clients who were on hunger strike a marked change in terms of their intellectual capacity.
Could you tell me how they organized the strike? Because many of them are in solitary confinement.
Well, they're probably what you're referring to is Camp 5, which is a facility with solid wall cells where there's very limited opportunity for communicating from cell to cell. However, people are able to shout to others there. I imagine that when the detainees are moved to go to an interrogation or a shower, they're also able to talk with people. So, as in really any prison context, information seems to flow pretty well around Guantanamo. Okay.
Military representatives claim that hunger striking is a common tactic used by Al-Qaeda to manipulate their captors. But I imagine that it's not a simple act of will to just refuse to eat for months at a time. It doesn't seem to me like a cavalier thing to do. Do you have a sense of what their actual intention is with this act?
Well, if I could first address the notion, if this is in fact what the military is saying, that going on a hunger strike indicates one is a member of Al-Qaeda.
Right.
Hunger strikes or tool is a protest tool that has been used by people around the world for probably hundreds of years, and I don't imagine the military is saying that Bobby Sands or Mahatma Gandhi were members of Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the military doesn't even accuse many people at Guantanamo of being members of Al-Qaeda.
Right.
That having been said, Guantanamo was designed to break down any sense of hope in the detainees so that they would be compliant for interrogation. Now, we know that many of them are not interrogated at all, and nobody thinks they have anything to say, yet that purpose of Guantanamo has certainly permeated the operation, and it's pretty effective. Many people have lost hope and don't see any way out of their current situation. They also know very well that the military's position is that they have not a single right as a human being that is enforceable anywhere in the world. You take the sum total of those circumstances, and what you have is men who say that the only way they can effectively protest or exercise any control over their own lives is through a hunger strike.
Mm.
We have another client who, rather than hunger striking, tried to kill himself by hanging himself and slashing his arm open. So this is certainly a theme that you could only expect at a place where people are held without trials and potentially for the rest of their lives.
Can you talk about that? You witnessed that suicide attempt.
I did. Juma, who is our client who tried to kill himself, is a very personable guy with whom I've had wide-ranging and informal discussions. He was one of the people who was being held in the solid wall cells of Camp 5 that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't see anybody from his cell, could rarely speak to people, and only by yelling out of his food tray slot. The only reading material he had was a Quran and family letters that were censored, as well as letters from me. The isolation was very, very rough on him. And in fact, after one of our meetings in the spring of 2005, he said to me, "How do I keep myself from going crazy?"
Mm-hmm.
In October of 2005, I was visiting with him. And at one point, he said he needed to use the bathroom. And in the area where we meet, for him to use the bathroom, he has to be transferred or moved just from the meeting area to a small cell, which is in the same room as the meeting area, but separated by a steel mesh wall. So I called MPs to come in because they have to move him. I left the room, and then a moment or two later, the MPs left the room, having moved him to the cell where the toilet is. A few minutes later, I hadn't heard anything from him saying that he was ready to talk. I was just feeling a little concerned, so I opened the door to the cell. I saw a big puddle of blood on the floor, and I saw Juma hanging by his neck from that steel mesh wall. Now, unfortunately, the door to the cell was locked, and he was, of course, on the opposite side of that steel mesh wall.
Okay.
So there was nothing I could do to help him. And he was unconscious. I called for guards. They came. They cut him down. He survived. He had surgery on his arm. Took about 15 stitches to close a gash in his arm that he had made at the same time as he was hanging himself.
Hmm. What is his condition now?
He is, as of the end of January, being held in a psychiatric block with several other patients who he says scream incessantly and incoherently. So in many ways, his isolation now is worse than it was in Camp 5 because he simply can't talk to those people he's housed with at this point. He's as despondent as I've ever seen him. I think he's truly without hope. He's on a 24/7 suicide watch with two guards stationed outside his cell at all times. Certainly there's no prospect for him to improve as long as he's kept under those kinds of conditions of isolation.
And what are the charges against Juma?
Well, Juma, like 740 or so of the detainees at Guantanamo, is not charged with anything. He is accused of having been present at Tora Bora. The military doesn't say when he was at Tora Bora or what he was doing, if he was there with anyone, simply that he was present at Tora Bora.
We're speaking with Joshua Colangelo Bryan. He's an attorney for several detainees at Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba. Joshua, given the isolation that you've described and the very limited communications between detainees and the outside world, how are we getting this information on what's occurring there? And how else can we find out?
It's really, the only channel for information from the detainees is through attorneys. When I go to Guantanamo, naturally I can take notes as to what my clients tell me. I then give those notes to my military escort, who sends them to a secure facility in Virginia. I can't take my notes out of the secure facility because they're presumptively classified, unless I give them to the government and they are declassified by the government. However, with respect to certainly the information I've described in terms of the hunger strike and other things today, my notes were declassified so I can share that information.
Mm-hmm.
One of the purposes of Guantanamo was to have a prison beyond all scrutiny,
mm-hmm.
which is undoubtedly a reason why the U.S. government fought so hard against having attorneys come to the base and continues to do so. Without the attorneys there really is no way to get any information about what's happening at Guantanamo, because the only other visitors who talk to detainees are Red Cross members, and they're mm-hmm. not permitted to disclose anything they're told.
I understand that Amnesty International has requested that the UN be allowed in. Has that happened yet to ascertain the medical condition of the hunger strikers?
Well, certain special rapporteurs, as they're called, to the UN Human Rights Commission were granted permission to visit Guantanamo, but under the same conditions that members of the press do. That is, they could tour certain facilities that the military selected, but they wouldn't be allowed to actually talk with any detainees. Because of those conditions, the UN special rapporteurs declined the invitation to go, thinking quite rightly that it would be a essentially useless exercise. I don't anticipate that members of representatives of the UN or anyone else is going to be granted access to detainees themselves.
How does the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005, which was signed into law by President Bush at the end of last year, how does that affect the detainees at Guantanamo?
Well, it's really sort of shocking that considering the military itself admits to the press and in court papers that it's holding some number of innocent people at Guantanamo and that no one at Guantanamo has received a fair hearing, that the Detainee Treatment Act wasn't passed. Mm-hmm. What the Detainee Treatment Act purports to do primarily is to strip federal courts of the authority to hear the habeas petitions that we've brought on behalf of our clients and other attorneys have brought on behalf of other detainees. It essentially says that the federal courts have no power to hear those claims. The right to habeas, is a right that has existed in Anglo-American jurisprudence since, 1215, if not earlier. So it's really striking to single out a group, especially a group that is, by the military's own admission, in some measure populated by innocence, to prevent them from exercising that right. The government has moved to dismiss all of our claims and our cases on the basis of the Detainee Treatment Act. The issue now is whether or not the act applies retroactively to cases that were filed before it became effective, or if it just applies to cases filed after it became effective. Those issues are before the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia and in some form in front of the Supreme Court as well.
Now, I'll ask you a political question here. When Senator John McCain first sponsored this bill, do you think this is what we ended up with right here? The Detainee Act is anywhere near what he initially intended?
Well, there are several components. There is the amendment that Senator McCain offered, which says that no one detained by the U.S. will be subject to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which, of course, when President Bush signed, he said would be interpreted in light of his constitutional authority. We know the administration thinks that the president's constitutional authority allows him to order torture and any other treatment that he deems fit. So there certainly is some question as to whether the executive intends to abide by the letter of that amendment. In addition to that, we also have the amendment I just described, stripping habeas jurisdiction, that was initially offered by Senator Graham. I don't know whether Senator McCain thought about that or not, but certainly to say that people should not be treated in a cruel or inhumane way on one hand and rob them of any real opportunity to complain about that sort of treatment on the other seems to be sort of an inconsistent position.
Now, if these methods are admittedly and fairly obviously inhumane and brutal, can you speculate as to why it would be in the military's best interest to prevent them from carrying out their own suicide?
Well,
it doesn't seem clear that they're interested in preserving their life.
I think from a public relations perspective, and this is based on my experience with a client who tried to hang himself in front of me, the military does not want anyone to die at Guantanamo. It has enough of an international press problem and public pressure problem with Guantanamo in its current form. If someone were to die through a hunger strike or suicide attempt, I think that would only increase the problem. Whether or not the general public in the U.S. really cares about this is another question.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, in my mind, the military's primary concern. One thing you have to remember, though, is that according to the military itself, the hunger strikers were not in any danger of dying.
Mm-hmm.
The military had said all along that they were in good health, that they were receiving tube feeding voluntarily, that they were getting along with their doctors, in press releases that had been issued throughout the course of the hunger strike. So we did not have a situation where the military was forced to make a choice between allowing people to die or taking these violent measures. In fact, as the military has admitted, it was tired of the hunger strike going on from a management perspective, and also because no jailer has ever appreciated a hunger strike from any perspective. So this was a policy choice, and frankly, it probably was not unrelated to the fact that Congress had just passed and the president had signed into law provisions saying that federal courts have no authority to hear any claims from the Guantanamo detainees.
So if it's not literally a measure to preserve life, that may explain why such a what you could call a violent dose of food feeding was used.
Issa, my client, spent 4 days getting fed two times a day with two bags full of fluids and experiencing this incredible pain. After 4 days, he said that he simply couldn't take it anymore and agreed to eat solid food.
Mm-hmm.
And that plainly the intent of these tactics was to convince people to end their hunger strikes. And considering that the military says now that there's a small handful of people still on hunger strike, I guess they were effective in the tactics they chose.
Mm. Joshua Colangelo, how do you expect to proceed from here? What's your next step?
Well, there's, as I mentioned, litigation in the Court of Appeals on the effect of the Detainee Treatment Act. We also work with the government of Bahrain, which is where our clients are from,
mm-hmm.
to encourage them to seek a diplomatic agreement for the release of our clients. In fact, last November, three of our clients, who'd been held for about 4 years, never accused of any violence, were returned home to Bahrain,
mm-hmm.
where they've been reunited with their families. They have since gotten married. One of them is expecting a child. They've gone back to school. They're trying to reestablish normal lives. And so we're hopeful that similar arrangements can be made for the three of our clients who remain. Because you have to remember that no matter what anyone was accused of, no matter how serious the accusation, if the person was from a Western country, with perhaps one exception, all of those people have been returned to their home countries, be it France or England or other places in Western Europe.
But in your client's case, that wasn't true.
For three of them, it was true.
Oh.
Three of them returned home in November.
Mm.
Three of them are still at Guantanamo.
Do you have a sense of the number of prisoners still there? I know that it changes a lot. It fluctuates.
According to the military, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 500.
Okay.
But there's no way to independently verify that number.
Hmm. Well, Joshua Colangelo, Brian, thank you for joining us today on The Politics of Food. We've enjoyed having you on.
Thanks for having me.